Hi, and welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And on this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to have with me Andrew Powell from Wishbone Ash, Andy Powell even, the master of the Flying V. And this is a band that has defined twin guitar from bands like Thin Lizzy, Iron Maiden, but also bands like Opeth, which I'll probably will touch on again later, because I think in some of their music, they probably captured some of the more kind of folky, ethereal sides of Wishbone Ash than some of the other bands may have done. I've always thought that Wishbone Ash are very unique in the kind of clean melody guitar lines that you had. I think it's like nothing else. But back at the beginning, when you first started, you were really into bands like Fairport Convention, weren't you? The kind of folky and soul aspects. Do you think that had a real impact on the Wishbone Ash sound?
Yeah, I really do. I spent the summer of 67 going to a lot of festivals. It was quite a new thing then. And I was only 17. And one of the first bands I saw was, I think actually it was 68 that I saw Fairport Convention.
Yeah.
And, Richard Thompson caught my ear immediately. It was that great little pocket of time where all these incredible British guitarists were coming to the fore. And what struck me about Richard was it wasn't the bombastic kind of Jimmy Page, Jeff Peck thing. It was a different aspect. And these guys weren't afraid to display their Englishness, if you will. So yeah. I thought, you know, I think I was always thinking in terms of being in a band. And if I were to be in a band, it would have to have a unique sound. And so that really did make an impression upon me, the fact that they were very, very comfortable in their own skin, and Richard in particular. And he had this melodic thing with his guitar playing, he still does. I see him frequently when he's on tour. And so that was a trigger right there, you know, for sure.
Is it also you were into like soul music as well, weren't you? So I know it's obviously the things like Cream, Peter Green, etc. But so you were coming from quite a mixed palette of influences. One of the things I've always wanted to ask, because I'm actually a big Deep Purple fan as well, is that story about you, because obviously I've researched this. It was May the 18th, 1970, you were opening for Deep Purple in Dunstable, and they were on the cusp, I think, of releasing In Rock probably at that point. And Blackmore's reputation of being a bit standoffish and a bit moody was huge even then. Even now. But you actually ended up having a jam with him, which led to Wishbone Ash actually getting their first bite of getting a record deal. Can you remember much about that?
Yeah, I can actually. And you've just triggered something. I never realized that May the 18th was my mother's birthday. So I must have been playing that show on my mom's birthday.
Wow.
She passed away last year at age 100. So that's like, you know, I'm suddenly being triggered here. But before I answer that question, and I do remember it quite definitely, you know, you have to realize when you mentioned about soul music, a lot of bands like Deep Purple and the players in heavy bands, actually, like for, you could say Across the Atlantic, Vanilla Fudge.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we all got our grounding is with soul music and Tamla. So we learned about how to put music together from listening to soul music, because those players who were a generation or so older than us, you know, they knew about arrangements because they were probably jazzers. And, you know, when we applied those techniques and those things we'd learned into, say, heavier music, rock music, the stuff had some kind of form, you know. So and so it went with Wishbone Ash and, you know, the Argus album. I mean, one of the things that is so great about it is it's composed, you know. It's arranged. But getting back to the encounter with Richie, you know, I was very much kind of an upstart. You know, I wasn't of that first generation of guitar players that came along in the late 60s.
Yeah.
I was... You know, when you're only sort of 17, 18, or even in your early 20s, you know.
You have no fear.
You have no fear. Yeah, but also a year or two is a massive, it's a massive difference in the way that you respect your elders. You know, so, you know, if I was, say, 17 or 18 and I saw Peter Green for the first time. I mean, he was obviously a couple of years older than me. That was massive. And the same with Ritchie Blackmore, you know. But I wasn't averse to having no fear, and I was quite a spunky at that point. We were on the up and up, and I was feeling my oats, and I was feeling that I had something to offer. So when he got up on stage and he was jamming, he used to do this part in the set where he would put a little Vox AC30 on stage. I don't know why he did that, but he would just plug his guitar, and he was messing around with his amplifier. And I was set up behind them. We'd already gotten there early because we were very keen to make our mark on that show. So he started playing. And the rest of Deep Purple, they'd all like hightailed it to the pub or the dressing room, because it was like Richie was going to be playing for about an hour, you know, driving them crazy. So he would play a lick, and then I plugged in my amp at the back, and I crept on, and I had my, I think it was an SG in those days, and I would mimic this guitar lick. Then, you know, he'd play a lick, and he'd turn around and look, what the hell's going on there? But I kept it up, and I didn't back down. And I think he quite respected that. And that's what led to the encounter. And he watched the show, and he said, you know, you guys are great. You know, have you got a record deal? You know, no, we don't. You know, well, I think I might be able to put you in touch with a couple of people that might help you there. You know, so he was hugely instrumental in to use a pun, in that situation.
Wow. Because he put you in touch with Derek Lawrence, didn't he? And then, of course, you got the record deal, and the first album comes out with a song on it that becomes one of your staple classics, stage classics, which is Phoenix. Now, this track came from numerous, three or four different jam sessions, and then you kind of glued it together. I'm just trying to envisage what that must have been like back then, that you're just jamming away and you're remembering things. But do you remember, was it a joint thing where you all suddenly thought, do you know what, if we put that with that and that with that, we could end up with this?
Well, yeah, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, we needed material.
Yeah.
And a big part of this jamming that we did was we knew we had to hone our chops, and we had to get good very quickly. So we just spent inordinate amounts of time in Miles Copeland's basement cellar in his parents' house in St. John's Wood, which is where we had together. And, you know, we would just jam. The place was like a little cauldron. Sometimes Stuart Copeland would come by. He was the younger brother of mine, he was a kid at the time. He would come in and like at the end of, say, about a 10-hour day session of just playing. I don't know how his parents put up with it, but he would come in and jam with us. And it was all about just playing and getting one with the equipment and trying to produce enough music to produce an album and a set. And so, there were lots of bits flying around. And, you know, in those days, you know, you didn't rely on digital recorders or even tape machines. It was all committed to memory.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it would you would say, you would get into a rehearsal, you could say, hey, you know that bit that we did 3 days ago, that little sequence, and you'd remember it. And you'd say to the other guy in the back. So we were kind of collectively producing each other. I mean, people talk about record producers and all this, that, and the other, and composing and writing. But being in a band, it's a sort of like a brotherhood, and you immediately get this trust going. And so the first thing you do is you just start producing each other. And part of that is remembering that part that somebody did 3 days earlier. And, yeah, what about if we sort of tack that on there? And then you try to play it. And we kept doing this with the song Phoenix. And, there were always never enough lyrics, because lyrics were the hardest things to write. That meant that was a bit like, going back to grammar school and doing your homework, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, who wants to sit in your room? I mean, thank God Martin actually did do it a lot. So he would bring, four or five lines to the rehearsal room, something that he'd been reading or thinking about. And we used to have these great late night discussions as we were driving to and from gigs about, when you're 18, 19, 20, he was a couple of years older than me, I think. And so I was 19, he would have been 21, 22. Steve Upton even older. So these guys, they'd read a bit more than perhaps I and Ted had. And so they had ideas. And, you know, we discussed these things, you know, like sort of pocket philosophies, you know, in the van. Yeah. What else are you going to do? You know, smoke a spliff and just start ranting on about Greek mythology or something. And so, you know, he'd bring these lyrics to the rehearsal. And it was our job to just imagine and visualize how that this sort of song that was coming out could be in a show. And that was a key part of the composition. How would this affect a live set? Oh, you know, probably that would be a show closer, you know, because we're ending with this frenetic jam. And it gives the guitar players, particularly Ted in this instance, the opportunity to really stretch out. And ironically, you know, that song has become the anthem. And it's like a 15 or 20 minute thing.
Yes. Yeah.
And it, for every guitar player that's been in the band, it's their chance to just show what they're made of. And ironically, Ted didn't take that many solos of the band. He was always, it would take the more gentler things. But this one is just out and out rocker, and he just goes full bore on it. And I'm really happy to just back him up on all the rhythm parts. And even the rhythm parts, they have this construction to them. So it's a, I always sort of introduce it on stage as a song that it was written a long time ago, but it's still being written. You know? Yeah. Because it is, you know.
Yeah. Mm. That, the other thing, because it's very easy for people to look now at twin guitar bands and say, oh, yeah, it's just a twin guitar band. But there's a lot of things going on behind that as an idea, because you've got egos and you were a young band, and normally when guitarists, as you said, you've got stuff you want to prove, you're kind of fiery. In Wishbone Ash, I mean, I don't know what was going on behind the scenes, but the way that you accommodate each other, it doesn't seem like there was a fight for you had the last solo, this one's mine, you know, I want this. It just gels. So you and Ted, and you've done this throughout Wishbone Ash's career, all the guitarists you've played with, there's a kind of feel or respect for each other. But obviously at that tender age, that must have been quite unusual.
Well, that's one of the things I'm most proud about, Phil, you know, because, there are guitar slingers, those guys that walk into town and I've had people in the band a bit like that, that sometimes on first meeting, They'll like show you their goods, you know, and it's like this, who's the quickest on the draw? Just makes me laugh because, as I said earlier, I come from that soul background where the key thing was not the player, it was the band. And for me personally, I mean, it's always been about bands, and it's always been about creating, you know, this sort of cohesive music. So thankfully, when I met Ted, you know, the two of us just were into that same mindset, and there never was a competition as far as I was aware. We kind of knew where each of us would go. Like, for example, Ted was always a more whimsical kind of mystical guy. He would always take these kind of dreamier solos and just wrench at your heartstrings. I would do it here and there, like for example on the song Leaf and Stream, but it was generally, you know, if there was going to be this kind of very floaty kind of tug at the heartstrings solo, it would have been Ted, and I would have taken just naturally, you know, it was like, you know, Sometime World, for example, I would go for the more frenetic, crazy solo, and there was never a competition about it. It's like, oh no, I want to play that, you know. It was often, you know, I might come up with the chord sequence behind like Sometime World is actually a great example from Argus, that song, because I came up with the rhythm part, and in the back of my mind was, wouldn't that be a cool part to solo over? So there was definitely that with both of us, I think. You know, we were thinking about rhythm parts as well as just playing lead. And, you know, I think that would have been a part of it also.
Fantastic. Because the next album, Pilgrim, you're talking about nobody really wanted to focus perhaps a lot on lyrics. It was all about guitars, because the next album actually was almost all about guitars, because it's almost instrumental if you actually stand back and actually look at the tracks as an overview. I mean, Vaz Diz, the opening track, which is jazz, which is a great track. I absolutely love it. It's one of my favourites. And, of course, the Pilgrim, which is another, I think I said in my review, the big box set, that you can never have too many versions of that. I just absolutely love it. But was this a period when you were again defining your sound, or was it the experimentation? I mean, Vaz Diz, I mean, whose idea was that? Because that really is like a jazz track.
It's mad. I mean, yeah, you know, I think Sometime World was the son of Vaz Diz in a way, but Vaz Diz it was Martin Turner's idea, because he, you know, he had an eclectic record collection. He listened to broad range of stuff. I mean, we all did. He discovered Brother Jack McDuff, and I recently actually listened to the original version of that. So it's not actually our piece of music.
But we
very definitely rockified it, and we took it into a rock band's idea of a jazz tune. And but you're right, that Pilgrimage album, it is largely instrumental. I don't think at that point, it wasn't until August that we became more confident with our vocals. And so I think that we were far more confident exploring instrumental ideas. And don't forget, at that time, every band, whether you were Yes or Genesis or Deep Purple, the thing was you had to be very definitive in your sound. You had to have your own defined sound. So we were searching for a sound, I think, on the second album. And I think are we going to be a folky thing? Are we going to be like folk rock? Are we going to be jazz rock? Are we going to be, I mean, now you just call it prog.
Yes, yeah.
But, you know, we were like looking for, you know, our strengths and what we could do. And we knew we could impress with our instrumentation. And so I think, yeah, that second album, you're absolutely right. I mean, song like Pilgrim started with a little riff. I think I came up with that.
Oh, yes, brilliant,
you know, it's like,
it's hypnotic, yeah.
So simple, you know, but on the end, it's quite complicated, you know, and then I think the, you know, all the parts in that piece, you know, they're musical. There's just some thought behind it.
They are, but they're also, they say they're simple riffs, but whereas it was a lot of music, you'd hear the riff, you'd hear what it's going to go, and you think, oh, Lord, it's going to go, I've heard that bit, what's he going to do next? But things like The Pilgrim and Vaz Diz, you think, no, this is good, it can stay here for a while. There's something almost like emotive and hypnotic about some of the riffs in that way.
Yeah, well, that is a sign of a good riff. If you come up with a good riff, and you just want to hear more and more and more of it. I mean, sometimes we play those riffs for hours. I mean, sort of like an Indian mantra or something.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we would literally get into a hypnotic state with it. I mean, you know, aided by certain illicit substances, no doubt. But, you know, you would just be like exploring, you know, getting into the riff, out of the riff, around the riff. And this is all part and parcel of having just endless time on our hands, you know, this was such a gift to be able to say, hey, you know what, I'm going to move to London, I'm going to move into a squat, I'm going to starve, and I'm just going to focus on music 24/7. And so, you know, most of my contemporaries were like maybe working in the city or, you know, got a university, or, and here I am just mucking around all day in a basement with three other musos. And, well, you know, we knew at the end of it, we had to have a plan. We knew we had to make it, but what a gift. You could just do the thing that you wanted to do at home all the time. I mean, I would be walking around at home when I should have been doing homework with a guitar around my neck, you know. And here I was able to just, it was like being put in front of the most amazing feast and being able to just gorge yourself on music all day long. Amazing.
Brilliant. Well, you mentioned the mystical aspect of like Ted's influences, but there was a mystical kind of like thread starting to appear through your album artwork with the first one, and obviously, you know, the second one, and then, of course, the one that has now just appeared as a big celebratory 50th anniversary set, Argus. Did you ever envisage that when you arrived with Argus, only your third album, still really young kids, really, that this album would literally cement itself in the consciousness of the public at that point?
Well, I think, Phil, you have to put it in context. No, we didn't really. We couldn't see the future, but it was an extraordinary time, right? It was an extraordinary time to be in a British band. It was an extraordinary time to come of age. I mean, I was born in 1950. So, you know, here am I and the rest of the guys coming of age in one shape or form. I mean, okay, so Ted was the youngest, I was the next. I'm 19, 20. So by the time Argus comes out, I'm like 22.
Wow.
Very young.
You know?
You know, Martin would have been 24, 25. Steve probably 24. Yeah, 24, Steve. So he was the older one. He was the one who by default would end up being the responsible one, looking after the accounts and controlling things to a certain degree. But no, I don't think we could have seen it. But that, on the other hand, we definitely had a plan. And the fact is that we had a great little team. We had Miles Copeland. We were the first real band that he managed. And his whole concept was like, you know, an American expat living in London. He was an anomaly anyway. People were like, who is this abrasive guy pushing this little band of, you know, wannabes? And but there was this plan. I mean, I remember meeting him for the first time, and on his office desk in the basement was this book, The Power of Positive Thinking. And so we would sit around and have all these chats about making it. And making it very definitely meant conquering Britain, going to Europe, and making it in the States, because he was American. So we couldn't have imagined the life he would have gone on to live for the next few years. But we certainly were trying to make it. We were trying to have success, and we were trying to be individual, if that makes sense. So, you know, Argus was the culmination of those three albums and those two or three years. I mean, at the time, I thought it was a hell of a slog, a long slog, you know.
Yeah, because, yeah. You know,
bands in the 60s would come along and they'd have a hit single like that. Well, suddenly we're in the age of...
The album.
The album. FM radio.
Yeah.
And the managers, the record labels, and the FM radio stations in the States, they gave a band the time to develop. So, you know, it was two or three years, and it was a wonderful gift, you know. Oh, an incredible gift to be able to do that.
I mean, how do you feel about revisiting an album after, you know, 50 years? I mean, because as a non-musician, for those of you watching this, if someone, you just stop someone in the street who was probably in their 60s or 70s, say, now go back to 1972. Do you remember X, Y, and Z? And most people have no idea. So you know, but as a musician, you know, you've got these signposts through your life. Where, you know, someone will ask you a question like I am saying, well, we're going back to 1972, release of Argus. And you go, oh, yes. So all of these things at the time, you didn't, as you said, you didn't know what effect, whether in 5 years' time anyone was going to be interested in this album, or whether, you know, whether you'd still be going. But here we are, 50 years later, Mad Fish have been in touch and said, I think we should do something about this. I mean, how does it make you feel when you look back on how people think now?
Well, I mean, more than anything, more than the sort of so-called fame, any money we might have made along the way, any kind of relationship. I don't know. More than anything else, it's a vindication of who you are. I mean, it's incredibly satisfying to think that you had a bit of an impact on culture, the culture, in some way, and that what you were doing sort of mattered, you know. And that gives me an incredible feeling of security, you know. I think that, I mean, I've obviously never left the band, so those songs and that music, they've always been with me through all of the phases of music in the last 25, 50 years. So I've never really taken my eye off the ball with those songs. But right now, I mean, everybody's sort of crystallizing the 60s and the 70s, and they're realizing that that was just an extraordinary time for popular culture. So it makes me feel very, very anchored in the culture, in Anglo-Saxon culture, if you want, musical culture. So I get a great feeling of warmth from it, a great feeling of security, if this is me trying to quantify it. But yeah, that's how it makes me feel. It's extremely gratifying, you know.
I think it's a very unique album. It's very English. It's like pastoral prog folk with a bit of sprinkling of blues in the guitar, but it's very different to anything. I know it gets compared with, you know, it came out the same year as Machine Head and all the rest of it, but it's very unique and it's timeless. The songs are, when we talk about your guitar style and you talk about, you know, your fiery guitarist, you know, trying to prove a point, there's something about your playing, and especially Wishbone Ash, I don't know, other people have said this, it's like whereas you remember riffs and you remember lyrics, you remember song structures, there's like little motifs in your guitar. There's like little licks that are like little earworms that I remember almost more than choruses or some of the songs. There are little, it's all the way through Wishbone Ash, but I think it really started on Argus. I mean, do you know what I mean?
I totally know what you mean. I mean, I really, really know what I mean. And this comes back to the soul band thing. It was like, well, if you were in a band, I was often the youngest in a band like that. If you had something to say, it better be good. And then the other thing was, you know, horn riffs in soul bands, they were those little earworm things. So I was brought up with punctuating things. And, you know, somebody once in the state, actually it was our American fan club secretary, John Brady, he once said to me, when he first heard Wishbone Ash on the radio, the only thing that could come to his mind as an American, and this is the way he was trying to describe it, he just said it sounded like gypsy rock. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Well, okay, I still am a huge fan of Django Reinhardt. So, you know, I was all, and but gypsy music, I mean, it always has this emotive thing. It's like with me, every time I take a guitar solo, there's this feeling of like, I'm going to fly, that flying V. I'm going to take off. And Django had that, you know, Django, he would just go on these flights. It's just the emotion would just come bubbling out. And to me, I had to, you know, when you write a song, there's that fear. When you write a really good song, you just don't know where it came from. It just comes out the ether. And it's like, that's creative inspiration. It's the same with guitar soloing. And, you know, often when you're just at the, just off the top of your head, you're composing as you're extemporizing, you're composing little riffs, and you hit on one. That's the trick of improvising. And you go, I don't know where that came from. Let me go back and revisit it a second or two later. And then you embellish it. And that is the art of improvising. And I think that, speaking for myself, I've always had that ability. In fact, the best solos that I do on record, they are always off the top of my head like that. I am not one of those guitar players that sits around very, very rarely and constructs a solo, you know, and then goes in the studio and play. I think that's the kind of the coldest way of making.
They're also very vocal, if you know what I mean, your solos.
Yes, absolutely. Phil, you know, you're the man. you're getting me. You're getting the band, and they are vocal. And I think that's why, I mean, I think Derek Lawrence, the producer you mentioned earlier on, I mean, say to me one time in the studio, it's all about the guitars, isn't it, Andy?
Yeah.
Because not to denigrate the vocals in any way, but, you know, I think that so many of the guitar parts, as you mentioned, they are little compositional nuggets.
Yes.
They're earworms all the way through, and Argus has it in spades, you know.
It certainly does. Some of the songs almost sound like they're coming together live on the album. There's like they're gently emerging in, as the track starts, and you know things like Throw Down the Sword, which I think you've described as the finest classic stadium rock anthem of all time, and obviously The King Will Come and Warrior. Those songs, in a way, probably are more relevant now in the times that we live in than they were then. You know, they're. I mean, what do you would you agree with that? They are almost. They talk to us now just as much.
Well, people talk about the Argus album and the songs being timeless. I mean, think about my situation. I've been playing these songs off and on for 50 years, and I never – people go, oh, don't you feel tired? That's, I'm going to sound like a cliched rock guy talking about his catalogue, but it's a fact. When I go on stage and I sing Throw Down the Sword, it sounds – and thank you, Martin, for the lyrics – it's as contemporary as it could ever and it ever has been. I mean, because these are universal themes, you know, the themes that were touched on in Argus lyrically were and are universal themes. Time, yeah. Space, relationships, where am I, who am I? I mean, I think somebody mentioned the opening line on the album, Argus, is I've got to rearrange my life. I mean, yeah. Isn't that the great human yeah. condition, you know? It's like, yeah. Why am I here? What am I doing? I have to get in touch with this. And I have to, I know it's a relationship song at the beginning, but then it gets into time and time was, and it's like, why are we here? You know? And then there's this whole sort of dynamic between war and peace, fighting and then making up. And that also is the great, I mean, look at it right now. The world's a mess. It's a nightmare. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing is that I've read before that you felt, I think, Mo, that it was in the record companies, a bit of pressure that you should have, who was going to be the real lead singer or, you know, the vocalist. But I never thought of that when I was listening to Wishbone Ash, because the other thing you say that I was saying earlier about the fact that telepathically you all kind of musically respected each other, but also you all had very similar voices.
High tenors,
I thought of bands like Camel, Yes, Genesis, but didn't have like the, you know, the guy at the front with the leather trousers on going for it. I never thought that Wishbone Ash needed that kind of vocalist. But what was the real pressure behind the scenes from a record label saying you need a, you know, who's going to be the real lead vocalist?
I think there was pressure from as things moved forward, we got into different phases of music, and
yeah.
the vocalist, I'm thinking of Daltrey, I'm thinking of Paul Rodgers, I'm thinking yeah. of those kind of people, they came to the fore. And, you know, you can't hang around too long. I mean, if your musical style, and you're right, it was very definitely a musical style. Some people in the States almost said it was a West Coast musical style where you sang as an ensemble, really. And you're right, we all had those high tenor voices.
Yeah.
And which sounded great when you harmonized, you know. And that was a definitive stamp, a definitive sound in the band, just as much as the guitar player. And sadly, we kind of rejected it. And there were different forces at play. There was the force of the management. There was the force of the record label. And there was the force of, you know, songs in general could be defined by a lead singer and a vocal sound. And suddenly, you know, that became a bit old hat. I think Martin Turner himself would even admit that he wanted to progress as the lead singer. He's in the center of the stage, and he wanted to be, he got very enamored for a period of time with David Bowie. He wanted to be an 80s, he wanted to move into the 80s, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think all those factors, you know, it was often mentioned that, you know, the rest of the band wanted to get a lead singer. And we did by default. We got an amazing lead singer. But the fact of the matter was we sort of lost our mojo as a band. And I think that that was the excuse, really. We didn't need a lead singer. All we needed to do was more of what we had already been doing.
Yeah, because in a way, the way that musically you developed on stage and played, the vocalist would have been probably going off to play congas halfway through some of the songs, wondering when he was going to be needed again. I think by handling it all yourselves, that was really good. Obviously, Argus was massive, number one album in all the kind of, you know, sounds, Enemy, Melody Maker charts. You know, you were everywhere in those polls that we used to see in the music papers. And there must have been a lot of pressure to come up with something that bettered it or was like it. And Wishbone Ash 4 wasn't like it. And I'm thinking that you had hardly any time, whereas now we live in an age where a band might not release an album for 3 or 4 years. And they've got time. Back then, bands were releasing albums once every 6 months, and no one would dare say to a band, take some time off, because you'd be scared that your audience would have disappeared. I mean, did you feel you were under a lot of pressure back then? Would time off have helped?
Massive pressure. Massive pressure. I think that's what led to the departure of Ted Turner. I just don't think that what we were put through was humanly really acceptable, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of us weathered it better than others. I was fortunate. I had a solid relationship. I was married. I got married, and that kept me grounded. But, you know, I mean, it's notorious in bands, relationships suffer. You know, when you're put under that kind of work regime, I mean, this is where I get my work ethic from, is as from being a teen and always working, working class kid, and then joining this band, which was just extreme. And it flogged us to death. And so, you know, but I think that other bands, like take the Pink Floyd, I've mentioned this before, they were far more of an esoteric kind of outfit, and they were, I think, much more in control of their career. They were a little bit older. And they didn't see anything wrong with just taking time out, and you know what, we're going to just sit back and think about this and digest it. And I think that's what we should have done after Argus. I mean, if you look on subsequent albums, there's always a little taste of Argus. There might be a one or two songs on an album on Wishbone 4, for example, that could have been on Argus, like Battle of the Beacon, or, you know, you can take some of the theme, but it gradually became watered down. And by the time the 80s came around, I'd sort of lost interest a lot, you know, because I think that, I was making the records, I was there, but, you know, the direction had gone. And what I loved so much, and what you obviously love, is that everything with Argus all led up to that band identity, which was such a strong identity and direction. And we should have just taken some time out, 2 or 3 years, and let the public just digest that album, let it ferment into the consciousness as it has now. I mean, but it's taken 50 years. But it could have been, and it could have bloomed, and we could have really given some more cerebral thought to the next thing, but we didn't. We were forcing another album.
It's the kind of album that if it was released now, you'd tour it for about 3 years. You would, wouldn't you? You'd tour it for 3 years, and people would still want to hear it. You'd have loads of time before you were asked to be moved on.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, because people really were buying the album, they were falling in love with it, and by the time they thought, "Well, Wishbone Ash are coming around," you were already touring the next one. You know, when you could still had lots of mileage. For touring Argus, really. I mean, there's some great songs on that. Everyone Needs a Friend is one of my favorites. Great. While I'm still on that, on the gatefold sleeve, you're sitting there in a rocking chair, and on the floor is an album by The Shadows. Was Hank Marvin an influence on you for that clean sound that you have?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. That's the message there, is everything comes from something, right? I mentioned the soul music earlier. Well, I mean, I doubt that there is a guitar player, a British guitar player, in the early 70s who, I mean, even Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, these people, they didn't like to mention Hank at the time in the early 70s because he was so overtly successful, and he was the guitar player in Britain. But now people go, yeah, you know what, I do owe an awful debt to Hank B. Marvin, because he was just, he laid down the groundwork for being a guitar player in the 70s, you know. And so we all got a little bit from Hank. So that's me just giving a nod to, that was when I was 11, the first real guitar music I heard was Hank B. Marvin. Yeah. Songs like Apache and Wonderful Land, you know, these are great little vignettes, great little things to learn as a fledgling guitar player. And that clean sound that you mentioned, that tone that he had, you can see that goes all the way through the British guitar players, myself included. And we all owe such a debt to him, you know.
Because the other thing about the twin guitar sound, which again, everyone just thinks about Wishbone Ash, is that Thin Lizzy, Iron Maiden, there was a lot more distortion, a lot more a typical rock sound.
Yeah.
But the twin guitar sound that in Wishbone Ash, there was there's a lot of acoustic guitars, but the lead guitar lines were clean.
Yeah.
And there's less place, I've always felt as a guitarist, there's less place to hide when you turn the distortion all the way down. you have to be more precise. And your guitar playing, I think that's why the lead guitars sound like they sound like voices, because you can differentiate between the notes. You can hear the gaps.
Like, I mean, I couldn't sum it up any better. I mean, I think that that, so as it comes from Hang, in a way, it starts there. When we first started touring America, we would go over there. We took all our equipment over from the UK. We would take this orange gear, which was actually German, very clean, hi-fi type guitar amplifiers, very powerful. And the gear that most American bands would get their hands on would be Fender or, in some cases, Marshall, which distorted quite, they didn't have a lot of headroom.
Yeah.
We would go on these festival stages with these powerful 200-watt amplifiers, and the sound companies would just go, what the hell is that? And also, we were doing things like, we were one of the first bands to bring digital delay into the field in the live show. So, yeah, fidelity was always the name of the game, in terms of getting good guitar sounds. Now, everybody's into that, they want that in their records, unless you're, say, a heavy metal act. But, yeah, distortion was not really part of it. Or if you did use a distortion, it had to be used very judiciously, for an effect.
Yeah, because it's not power chords a-go-go with Wishbone Ash. Very, very different. Live Dates, the double album, is one of the best live double albums out there. Everyone was releasing live doubles, and it's the last one with Ted on. It's absolutely fantastic. And then Laurie Wasfield joins after that for There's the Rub, which is, I think, another absolute wonderful album. And he fitted in like a glove, didn't he?
No, not really.
Didn't he?
It took a lot of work. He fitted in terms of, like, he wanted to be part of a successful band. He wanted to be successful, so that was good. But stylistically, I had to work really hard, actually.
I guess because he wasn't as whimsical like Ted, was he? He was more fiery and how many notes have I got? Yeah.
Yeah, he was. Well, he came from a country background, so he was a picker.
Yeah.
He wasn't a single string soloist per se at that time. So he had to he liked people like Jimmy Page. I know that. He liked the riffing, but his style, he had to very quickly play all those Ted parts, and he had to become a single string, which he did very well. So, yeah. And I, conversely, had to learn very quickly at to kind of up my rhythm chops, and my picking. I wasn't a picker, but I had to learn that very quickly. So it took a lot of work, actually, and a lot of adaptation. On many levels, and we were already halfway through the writing of There's the Rub when he joined. So it was a tall order to produce that album, so much so that when we got to Florida, and we were fairly well prepared, two-thirds prepared, I would say. And but Bill Simpson had no idea that Ted Turner had left the band, and he was actually gutted because everyone, that was the band, So to his credit, he accommodated this change, but it was fraught with tension and it was trouble. It was, as I said earlier, my whole thing is I love bands and I'll do anything. Even in a group of people sitting in a room, I'll do anything I can to bring out the best in the group. I'm all about that. And that's what I personally put into gear. I was a pragmatist and I did what I could to further it. I mean, hell, I went to New York and invited Laurie to join the band. So I was committed,
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy.
Well, it's interesting because obviously from a fan's perspective, I remember I think it was my last year at school, and everyone bought that album saying, have you heard the new Wishbone Ash album? It's a real step up from the previous one. So it really hit,
It was technically, yeah. We had a great American producer in our American studio. We had this, new guitar player. Laurie brought a lot of stuff to the table in his style, and don't forget, There's the Rub. It did break some cool ground, new fresh ground just like, you know, the earlier album Argus did in a way, but it didn't have that. It didn't have the what's the word? The compositional quality, that kind of sound. But it was a different thing. And it was the album, I always call it the soundcheck album for Hotel California, because the day we left the studio, yeah, the Eagles came in to the studio, and the same producer, same engineer, but they had great, incredible songs and great singers. And they produced that album, which has a fair bit of twin lead guitar playing on it.
It does.
So massive amount of experience was gained by the production team in working with Wishbone Ash on There's the Rub. And I firmly maintain that would have just rolled over into the guitar side. I mean, Joe Walsh was even vaunted at one point by Bill that Joe was looking for a band. And he was like, well, what would you think about three guitar players being in a band, Andy, Laurie?
Yeah.
I remember looking at Laurie and we were like, can't see that working.
Yeah.
And bingo, what happened? So, you know, these are the things behind the scenes that people don't realize. You know, they just go, oh, that was an amazing transition. That was an amazingly easy album to do, wasn't it?
You mentioned that a lot of the music had already been written before Laurie joined. Was the instrumental Fub, was that one of them, or was that...
The first half was written.
Yeah.
And, we had in our mind that it was going to be a kind of a grandiose, anthemic thing. So we had those guitar parts written, the fourths and the... And I think we had a working title of... the kind of a joke title, but Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. You know, it was like, you know, this kind of, we were thinking about filmically, actually, we were thinking like film music, like you mentioned the Hypnosis. I mean, those guys with their album covers, they were actually former film students.
Yeah.
They went to film school together and they dropped out and they became album designers. So if you look at all of their album covers, they're all very filmic. And again, you have to put yourself back into the time. There wasn't the internet. There wasn't,
nah.
We hadn't seen Star Wars. We hadn't seen, you know, Avatar. We hadn't had any of that.
There's no Photoshop. Yeah.
All those guys, no Photoshop. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, you know, we were thinking as musicians in terms of that, like imagery. So we had a lot of those ideas together, but then Laurie came in and just came up with his frenetic little arpeggio guitar runs and lines, and yeah, it was cool.
It was like, well, I remember at the time thinking it was almost like Son of Phoenix. It was like the next generation of that, you know, really long workout, you know, extravaganza. Yeah. Really great track. Now the album after that didn't follow where a lot of people probably thought you were going to go, which was Locked In, which I know probably tapped into some of the soul influences, but I remember at the time, from a perspective of being a fan, that it wasn't what I expected. What are your views of that now?
Well, that was a period in time where, you know, I talk about bands and I talk about being a cohesive unit, and we had too many disparate things impacting us at that time. We changed our label to Atlantic. They didn't really know what to do with us. We moved to America for a period of recording, and you know, a lot of people say it was because of the tax avoidance and that kind of thing. That was part of it. We were earning decent money, so we were getting taxed very, very heavily on our income. So we decided, with this American manager, this new label, that we would go with one of the greatest producers ever, which was Tom Dowd.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was all a mighty failure, really, because Tom was not in a good space personally. He was going through a divorce. He'd done all these amazing records. He didn't really know who we were. He didn't know about our sound, our big rock sound. You mentioned the sound earlier, clean guitars. He was of that soul background, obviously R&B. That was his forte. So here we are. We've lost our manager. You know, we just done a – I think it was that time that we'd lost our manager. Yeah, we we were rudderless. So we were in a foreign country. We're in New York, for God's sake.
Wow.
We knew nothing about, and we were put in the studio, like almost like a session band. And we were, of course, we were overawed with being in New York, and we thought these guys knew what they were doing. Yeah, guy, Andy, go and plug into that Fender Champ, get the lamp over there in the corner in this very dead studio and play some rock guitar, but you've got a Steve Cropper setup, you know. And it was just like, no, it was like being asked to put on a suit of clothes that you just felt totally uncomfortable with. And my whole memory of the whole album session was just being completely uncomfortable. You know, he didn't like our vocals. He sent us for singing lessons. It was totally demoralizing. I mean, we were strangers in a strange land, and we were trying to produce. Now, we did okay under duress, I guess. Laurie, I think, was less impacted because he didn't have the past in his mind to carry forward. I had this feeling of, man, we've done all this amazing work. I had that 4 years, 5 years with Ted, and we had played some of the biggest shows that you could think of in America. And here we are playing combo music in a little studio in New York with somebody who really doesn't give a shit, you know. And it was just completely demoralizing for me, so much so that, you know, on the way back from after the final listening session in the studio, I just was like, you know, I was in tears. I was just like, what am I doing with my life? I thought it was game over. I really thought it was game over.
Yeah, because it was so different to, I mean, because people tend to look back and think, oh, it's just an album that came out after August. But we're only talking like about 4 years, wasn't it? It was just four years later this happened. However, later that year, you bounced back with actually my favourite Wishbone Ash album, which is New England. I think I just a backstory for me, I just started work. I was working in a factory, which is horrible.
Oh.
And I used to come home and sit at the kitchen table in Mum and Dad's house, and Robin Valk at the Birmingham station called BMRB started playing tracks from the new Wishbone Ash album. I can remember them exactly. It was In All My Dreams, You Rescue Me, Runaway, When You Know Love, Mother of Pearl. And they just connected with me. Like I was saying earlier, there was these little guitar motifs. Because there was no Walkmans in those days, but I was going to work and I was singing the guitar solos in my head. You know, yeah. That album to me is just so, so special. I mean, did you, based on what you'd just done with the previous one, did you know when you did New England, I'll say Laurie, you know, must have been fitting a bit more like a glove by this point because the music is just immaculate.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. He and I and Martin, Steve, we were just, it taught us such a massive lesson of what not to do when we did Locked In. And I think it was at that point, we actually had a lot of things going for us. We were living in the Connecticut countryside, and we had this like band headquarters, which was this rented place on 14 acres with a huge basement that wasn't doing anything, and swimming pool, and you know, this bucolic life we were all leading, and we were directionless. And I think it was me that said, "Look, why the fuck don't we just get a mobile and turn this studio into this basement into a studio and make us record at home? Let's just forget all the crap, all what everyone's telling us. Let's just do what seems the most natural thing." And I've done this actually several times in my career now. I've made albums in barns and farms and homes that I've owned, and it's become a modus operandi. I mean, a lot of people do it now, you know. We just literally, we still kept the connection with Miami. So we got the Albert Brothers, came up with a mobile, and we just and Martin and the engineer Mark Emery, they turned the basement into a rudimentary sound capsule. And we ran the lines down from the mobile truck. And we were able to get this sound in the room, which we should have done on Locked In. This was the sound. It was as close as we could approximate a stage sound, but in a studio. So we had big speakers going, we had all the reverberation, we had the delay. So all the sound that you would get in a big stadium show created in the basement of a house. And then we got our mojo back. And And it was a reaction to Locked In, and thank God we did it, because then that impelled us forward, you know, for a few years with that album. And you're right, those songs, they had a magic to them. And I think that, you know, we sort of wrote, we had a vibe going. It was the middle of Connecticut summer, very, very hot summer, I remember. And you can even hear that because we recorded the crickets outside.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it was cicadas, actually. Yeah. But everyone says crickets. But, you know, that was where we were, you know, we had no air conditioning down there. We're in shorts and vests, and we're working. We're really back to that old basement mentality. Get into the basement of the house and get the rock and roll going, get the condensation dripping off the walls, the sweat, and just get away from this session musician, really goofy New York. No, we weren't that. We were just totally not that. So we were back to doing what we could do best.
It's also an album of such light and shade as well. We're talking about the really gentle stuff that on, you know, on Argus and stuff. Well, on this, you've got Lonely Island, Candlelight, and that, again, it was, you felt like you were back to doing like music with every texture, you know, aspects of jazz, folk, rock, you know.
Well, we would sit around talking about these things, and we always recognized the fact that dynamics was a huge part of our stage show. You know, one of the first things we ever did, the first song we ever wrote was Blind Eye, I think. Well, and we would always like open the set with that, you know, and just shock the shit out of people, you know, with a song like that. So yeah. Dynamics, you know, and then, oh, my God, they're going to go into a jazz thing. And then, you know, as you mentioned earlier with Phoenix, you know, these sort of gentle, these long songs that would then morph into this frenetic, psychedelic thing. We were always talking about it. So, yeah, I'm sure we would have been sitting around at that point saying, let's get back to some of that, you know.
It's a very joyous album as well, you know, Outward Bound, instrumental. It's a very upbeat, positive, life-affirming album. So, you know,
life-affirming, that's totally it. I mean, you know, I remember, I just remember the atmosphere around it was all about that, reaffirming who we were. That's exactly what it was about, yeah.
And the next one, it was actually looking that when I was doing pulling my questions together, it's actually the first album where you all appeared on the cover, Front Page News, really. The first one where the band actually appeared. And it was, again, a different flavour to what you might expect. It was more kind of laid back in places. And some of the members of the Now Spinning group on Facebook, this is their favourite album, Front Page News. And I remember seeing you on tour at Birmingham Odeon for this one, when the tour program was like a newspaper, which is very clever. What were your feelings about that one?
Well, again, every album is a record of the time. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's so great about long playing records. You're obviously a fan. I can see them all there.
Yeah.
You're recording a moment in time in history. And so that album, again, we're keeping the connection with Miami. We're in this sort of discovery mode of America. We're almost becoming Americans in a way. We're keeping the connection with that studio and the production teams that were down there. But we went down and did some work. We used to rent houses down there instead of staying in hotels. We always try and create an environment where we were. So I remember that, and I remember, again, just heat, you know, and I think that kind of gives vent to what you've just analysed there, the laid-back nature of it all, you know. Making records in Miami, that's like, whose idea was that, you know?
Yeah.
The humidity and the heat, that's what comes over a lot. The cover's got this kind of tacky movie poster quality about it. There's stories going on there. There's weed, you know, involved. it's just four young men kind of discovering that, another vibe, really.
After that, the band returns back to the UK. I think, is this about the time that you stayed in the USA, is it, for No Smoke Without Fire?
No. I mean, I came back.
It all came back.
There was more work happening. There was things going on in Europe. You know, I think that out of the four of us, I never totally came back. Yeah. I was always back and forth, back and forth. At one point, I had a house in England and a house in the States. I just couldn't. I'm one of those people where if I've experienced it in my life, I bring it along with me. You know, I don't like selling things. I'm a bit of a hoarder. And I also hoard experiences and relationships. I can't just, I wanted to keep a foot in both camps. But yeah, but we were back recording in Britain again, which was another experience altogether. I think for a couple of the other guys, they were very happy to be back in England permanently. So it's become, that's what's happened actually.
And then around this time, Martin leaves just after Just Testing. And in the music world, one of the bands that have been influenced by you is now charging ahead with a new genre called the new wave of British heavy metal. So all of a sudden, that's where everyone's head was, or it seemed to be. But the thing was, with bands like Iron Maiden, everything was turned up to 11, you know, great band, but there was, with their twin lead guitar sound, but there was no soul, no blues, no folk. And it almost felt like at the time that Wishbone Ash now, for the first time, weren't being able to follow your own sound. You're almost being pushed gently towards saying, I think you should do something more like that. Did you feel like you were on the outside looking in?
Yeah, I did. Because while we were in America, I mean, we'd escaped punk. We'd escaped a lot of movements that had occurred in Britain and Europe. Yeah. We were oblivious to them, you know. It was like we were the Eagles or something. We didn't know what was going on, you know. We were thinking like Americans, you know. Suddenly we come back and we're being impacted, you know, the business around the band, the people, the influencers. We had new British management. It was our old agent, our ex-agent. And they were after all, they were out booking these bands. They're seeing the trends, you know. Kerrang! Magazine came up.
Yeah.
All of these things, another generation of acts were ruling the roost, and we're coming back into that genre, like fish out of water, you know, totally. But I mean, we could rock out as good as well as any of them, you know, but it wasn't our ethos. It wasn't what we were getting our rocks off on every night, but we could do it. So I think that was when the malaise set in. And I think that not in terms of being musicians, but in terms of being a band, you know, with a direction. And one of the things, like it or loathe it, about, say, a band like Iron Maiden is they stuck with their thing, you know, through thick and thin.
Yeah, they've not deviated, yeah.
And they still do it.
Yeah.
You can hate it, you can loathe it, you can go, what's that all about? Or you can be, I'm a massive fan. But it's that loyalty to the audience. And I think that we were so busy trying to figure out who we were at that point that we forgot that we had, you know, we had this amazing audience. And it wasn't until much later that, you know, I personally actually really looked at what we created and people like yourselves that come along with the band and were quite willing to kind of support us and lift us up. I mean, so much of a band's ethos is the audience as well, the fans. You can't differentiate. I mean, take a band like AC/DC. Those are great bands that are only great because they bring the audience along with them. Well, you know, some people say we just were too up our own assholes to do that. We were too into self-analyzing ourselves, being in a foreign country. Not that we didn't have great fans over in America, but it wasn't like the old fans when you probably came in. Those early fans that followed us around the town halls and still come to the gigs I'm doing, a lot of them, you know, it's part of being a movement. So our thing became fragmented. We went to Japan, we went to America, and each of those generations that came along, they had their own idea and their own version of what the band was. Like you mentioned earlier, I mean, a group of audience members that would have followed the band and come into the band around a period of There's the Rub would have been fairly oblivious of those first three albums and that journey. I was never oblivious to it because it was.
Yeah, you were there.
I was there. It was part of me, you know, it still is. Everyone had their own ideas of what Wishbone Ash was at that point. And they were impinging those ideas onto us on what we should do and how we should go. And, yeah, some members in the band were more gung-ho to try that sort of thing. I think Laurie himself was much more – he could have been in one of those bands. And I think probably he probably yearned to be in a band like that. That wasn't really where I was coming from. So I think you got this fragmentation within the band at that point. It was a direction issue.
I mean, you gave it your best shot. I mean, they're good albums, Twin Barrels, oh, yeah. Burning and Raw to the Bone.
Totally, yeah. Yeah. We're nothing if not professionals by that point.
Yeah. they were good albums, but they weren't for long-term fans. There was a feeling that you were leaving, I think, behind your trademark sound.
I think for me personally, that was the case as well. I couldn't get behind it as a band identity, but I could go in the studio and I could certainly play it, and I could give it my all, and I could become that as like an actor,
like
an actor on a stage. But it wasn't until much later that when the pressures were off that I was able to regroup and produce a bunch of albums with different people under the name of Wishbone Ash, because I never left, where I felt much more comfortable in my skin. But that period of time, I was probably the least comfortable as one of the band members. Maybe Steve Upton as well. I mean, we weren't comfortable in that skin. I think Laurie was driving. He was desperate for the band to have another crack of the whip.
Yeah.
But it never really happened, not in the way that Argus did.
No.
But like I mentioned, and you mentioned earlier, I mean, it was a cultural shift. Argus was part of a movement, and it was at the pinnacle of that batch of groups that were coming up in the early 70s. We weren't ever going to get that again. We certainly weren't going to get that in the 80s, the 1980s, because there was a younger generation coming along with a lot more piss and vinegar. They were less distracted. They were focused like we were in the 70s.
Yeah.
Focused on their direction and their game.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
However, in 1987, Miles Copeland entices you all back together for the total instrumental album called Nouveau Calls, which actually is one of my favorite albums by you guys. And it was obviously, it's completely instrumental because that's what Miles was trying to do with his No Speak label.
Yes.
But it does capture, with all of you, the Wishbone Ash sound came pouring out of the speakers again. Your guitars playing, the feel, the emotional aspect, even without, again, as I said earlier, the instruments with the voices. What are your thoughts now looking back on that particular album?
Okay, the negative and positive. I think the recording was a bit clinical. I think if we were to record some of those pieces now, it would be a much more organic, fatter sound. That's just on the guitar sound.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think the album was a real creative blast, particularly between myself and Martin. I literally got off the plane with a little Galleon Kruger amplifier and a PRS guitar. This one here is this one of the first ones that were ever made by Paul Reed Smith. And I had this guitar. I just bought it in Manny's, New York. And I was into traveling light. And I came on the plane with this little amplifier, looked like a lunchbox.
Yeah.
And he was in the studio in Portobello. And what was immediately apparent to me was within literally a couple of days, Steve was there. It was, as usual, Steve was slightly on the perimeter, waiting to hear what the ideas would be. And Ted wasn't there. Ted actually didn't arrive till about the last 2 days of the recording. So what was immediately apparent to me was the incredible synergy between Martin and myself. Immediately, I mean, I suppose in the early band, I'd been something of a muse. I mean, you have to kind of, again, everything is context. When Martin was in a band with his two brothers, which was Kim and I've forgotten the name of his other brother. Anyway, but they he came up to London, and he was used to being the older of three brothers.
Yeah.
And so he was able to kind of enforce his ideas and his will on those guys. And then when I came into the band, Ted came in, we were like surrogate brothers for him, I think. And so it was very much a band of brothers, but different kind of brothers.
Yeah.
And I think I'd been something of a muse to Martin. I was obviously very able to translate ideas and vice versa. So we were very good as a partnership in the early band at producing each other and getting the best out of each other. And what became immediately apparent to me was on the Nouveau Calls sessions, it was just him and me sitting around a desk going, I've got this idea. What would you do with that? Well, I would take it in that direction. I would add this and I would do that. And then conversely, he'd come up with an idea and we do the same with each other.
Yeah.
And so that album just came super quick. The ideas came tumbling out, and he was there on the desk able to do the recording, and then we'd bring Steve in and can translate just like we did in the old days. You interpret this, you know, can you get a bit of a feel like this on this piece of music, you know? And then, yeah, that was it. So it was really the three of us, and then Ted came in right at the very end. We took an awful lot of persuading to get him to come over, finally came over, and he just pretty much added a bit of slide guitar, a couple of little bits of guitar here and there on it. That was it.
So, but obviously Miles wanted it to be instrumental because of his No Speak label, but as Wishbone Ash, you were all back in the room together. Were some of those songs, did they come with vocals, or have you looked back and thought, if we put vocals on, this would have been a totally different animal?
Yeah, a couple of them, they were ideas that independently we'd written with vocals.
Ah.
But we didn't bring that to the table because the brief was instrumental.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you mentioned earlier with Wishbone Ash music, the riffs and the guitar melodies
are the voices.
And so it was completely natural, and they completely stood up on their own two legs or four legs.
Absolutely.
You know, as pieces, you know. That's the brilliance. That was the brilliance of the writing team. And when I look back on it time again, that's what comes to the fore. And so the fact that there were no vocals on there didn't matter then.
Yeah, I think, as I said, it's in my top five. Now, although Ted came in literally the last 48 hours, he obviously had a great time because he was very keen then for it to carry on. So you did two more albums, Here to Hear and Strange Affair, which were quantum leaps away from Raw to the Bone and, you know, what had gone before. So it was the 80s was still a confusing time for the Wishbone Ash brand in a way.
Confusion reigned, I think so, yeah. I mean, by that time, Phil, I mean, we each individually had such disparate lives and we were adults, you know. We weren't this little army platoon with, you know, fighting on our bellies and, you know, in the trenches. We all had very complicated lives, and we were coming together again. I mean, I had this place in the UK, along with Martin, we were going to be a partnership, actually. That was the idea. Let's set up this studio. He had all the equipment. I had the property, and the idea was let's set this up and have a little production operation, which would have been incredible. Would have been like the culmination of a really feel-good thing of all the years and the sweat and toil that we put in together. We could have had that, and we could have used it as a little production center where music for our individual projects and Wishbone Ash projects could have come forth. But it wasn't to be. And we produced those other two albums, and I think there were too many forces pulling in different directions. There were too many geographical issues. Mm. I had one foot in the United States. I had one foot managing this place over in the UK, which was a nightmare. Ted was very much Los Angeles-centric person at that time. Martin, very much UK-centric. And Steve was going through major personal issues to the point where he actually left the band again.
Yeah.
His marriage was about to sort of devolve. So life really at that point was getting in the way with all of us. So I think if it had happened 10 years earlier, it would have been great. But certainly the Nouveau Calls, you know, we talked earlier about an album being a record or a recording of a moment in time. And that's what we all love about LPs, you know. It's very distinctly and very definitely that's what it is. And I'm proud of it, actually. Yeah. I am.
Well, then the next one I really, really like is Illuminations, which was from mid-90s, I think. But did you crowdfund this album? Is that because if you did, this is before the internet and social media.
Okay. In the early 90s, this is before the term crowdfunding even existed.
Yeah.
I was working part-time on a farm. It was a teaching farm, an organic teaching farm. And we would run summer camps for kids. And I was still making music, still touring.
Yeah.
But when I wasn't touring, I would go there and I would just be on this farm. And it was one of the best times of my life, actually. And I actually wrote music while I was doing all this stuff, teaching kids and tending the animals and cleaning out pigsties and God knows.
Yeah.
It was incredible. But I was listening to public radio. I would come over at lunchtime and I would listen to NPR, National Public Radio, and I heard about this folk singer, this girl, who would she was trying to make a record. And NPR always supports fledgling artists. And she had done exactly what I ended up doing, was she had raised money with her circle of friends and fans to make an album. At that point, you know, the music business with Napster and everything was devolving.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was no money. And we wanted to make this album, Illuminations. So I literally, once again, I went back to the fan. We started a website, which was, we were one of the first bands that ever got a website.
Yeah, again, yes, it's very early, yeah.
Very early on. And people started to write in. There was a forum. It was very, very active. And I just tapped into some of these friends and fans that I got to know over the years. And I said, look, if you want to put some money into this project, all we need is about $20,000, and we can do it cheaply, and we can do it effectively, and anyone who puts in will get their name on the album, and you'll make 15% return on your money, which was ridiculous, is the naivety. I mean, no one would do that. But people did step up to the plate, and they did it, and we completed the project. And so, yeah, I take my hat off to that NPR program and being inspired to do it. And the fans were just amazing, you know, and some people put a couple of $100 up, some put a couple of thousand in, and we made the record.
And it's a good one as well. Tales of the Wise, nearly 10 minutes long. There's some really, really fantastic stuff on there. No, it's a really, really good album.
Thank you. Yeah. We recorded it in a local recording studio in Reading, which is the town I live in Connecticut, and moved to that town at that point. And, I getting back to that whole thing of creating an environment, and we had John Etchells come over from the United Kingdom to engineer the project. And, it was getting into the countryside, creating an environment just like I'd done in UK and like we'd done in on the New England album. And so, you know, it had all those elements going for it. So it had some sort of depth to it and some soul, you know.
Well, the next stage is actually also features some of my favourite albums. And I think this is where I think the Wishbone Ash sound, to me, as a fan, really seemed to reemerge and really back on track. And this is like, you know, the Bonafide, Clandestiny, Power of Eternity, Elegant Stealth, Blue Horizon, Coat of Arms. And this one in particular for me, Clandestiny, I think this is marvelous. Well, Bonafide's really good. Well, they all are, but I've got to land somewhere. But this one, this to me everything seemed to come back together. You also got it's Bob Skeet on bass. He's been with you for 26, 27 years now, and he's a great player. Did you feel that after what happened in the 80s and obviously the crowdfunding in the 90s, you were back, Wishbone Ash were back on track?
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, that was a very creative spell on Clandestiny.
Oh, it's brilliant.
You
know,
and thank you very much. I'm so heartened to hear that because there's a lot of me in that album. The songwriting is a little bit kind of cataloging what I was going through emotionally at the time. And I'm putting my thoughts down into the music. And it was a great band. I mean, we had Marty Mannen on the guitar from Finland. And so, yeah, it's the beginning of the, I mean, I think that Illuminations is kind of a standalone album, really. It's me working my good friend Roger Philgate on guitar, but it very much stands on its own. But Clandestiny is, as you mentioned, the beginning of a slew of very comfortable, well-recorded, well-written albums, and really the. You know, Illuminations kicked off the rebirth of the band in many ways. And that album has got a lot of emotional content on it and great guitar playing, great production, everything. I mean, I was down at Blue Jay Studios up near Boston, Massachusetts. Great album.
Well, I saw you on that tour, actually, down where I am in Penzance in Cornwall. You played a small little theatre down here when that album came out. But I do think it's... I think Bob's bass headstock was about that far away from my head.
Bob's my new, he and I have been together for, as you say, 26 years now. So
yeah,
this is a completely new, but this is the band, the latter half of Wishbone Ash, the career. It's been very productive and very enjoyable, I have to say. I mean, a lot of what goes into producing a great band, and you'll find this in any band, when we were young kids with Piss and Vinegar and angst, there was a lot of turmoil, you know, comings and goings and this sort of desire, this thrusting forward to try and make it. And then you get in the latter half of this band's career, and it's like finally we've just gone down all the blind alleys, you know, and we've just come down to a very comfortable way of touring and recording, and we've produced some sterling work.
Yeah, it sounds effortless, and I think that's what I felt that Clandestiny was like. Could have easily come from the same kind of New England period. It just felt like effortless.
Yeah.
The music was joyous, very uplifting. Guitar playing again was like, you know, really...
Stellar.
Yeah, stellar. Absolutely stellar. But no, songs like Healing Ground, Surfing on a Low Wave, it's just brilliant. And of course, you've carried on with that feel. And you sound like a band having a great time. You know,
that's exactly what we are. I mean, Phil, I can't be at this stage in my life and not be really enjoying things. And I really want to be in the studio and on stage. And I think it shows when we go out on tour, just to be with a bunch of guys. It's like a good night down the pub. And that's the way I really enjoy touring and being in a band now, because I've fought all the battles. I've fought all the wars, and I just want an environment where I can be making music in a very pleasant way, and that's what I'm so fortunate and so blessed to have right now. So I'm a happy guy.
Fantastic. Now, a lot of those albums obviously came out during the height of the CD period, and I just wondered, just out of interest, because I know Bonafide came out as a limited vinyl edition. Can you see things like Clandestiny and other ones like, Elegant Stealth coming out on vinyl as limited runs or something?
Actually, Elegant Stealth did come out.
Oh, right. Okay.
That is available. But maybe so, because there's this huge resurgence with the interest with vinyl. I mean, everybody's buying turntables and vinyl. I think people are understanding now, which we understood back in the day, the joy of having these artifacts and this ritual and this, the whole thing of playing an album, having an album, what an album represented.
Yeah.
And that's what's so great about the box sets, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
It rekindles that. You've got so much material there to look at and listen to. And they could certainly down the line, that could be an opportunity for sure.
Because as you just mentioned, the box sets gives a fan, whether you're an old fan or a new fan, the chance to just literally dive into a band's entire career. And I think that's what the Vintage Years box set, which is probably one of the best box sets ever produced, able to do. But the other thing that was interesting about that is that the amount of live stuff that was in that box set, literally the equivalent of double album after double album of live concerts. Now, a lot of other bands give them the chance of saying, we can do a box set, lads. Have got any stuff to release? And they'll go, no. But as you had all this, all professionally recorded, was that, that's quite unusual. Were you, how come you recorded so many of your concerts?
So I just think we were just very respectful of the shows we were doing and the fact that we wanted to capture them. And when we did the Live Dates album, for example, where a lot of this material came from, we were recording every night with the Rolling Stones mobile. So there was a lot of stuff in the can.
In the can, yeah.
But I think that, you know, within the band, we were always very respectful of the recording process. And I think the marriage between that and the live shows, we were always very conscientious about sound and trying to get a great fidelity both on stage and in, you know, these recordings. And I think we always just had an interest in recording our material whenever we could. And I think a lot of people around us realized that because they realized that we were a great live band. And how could they capture that? You know, managers, agents, people, you know, you guys should do another live. I mean, we've done more live albums than any band I can think of.
Everything's
recorded. And
they're all different.
They're all different. Yeah.
And you can never have too many. You can never have too many copies of Pilgrim. So, yeah.
I mean, you know, if you're a tapehead, you get into those differences. And but, you know, I think that because we always had such great shows. And, in a way, the new movement that's out there now is jam bands. I think if Wishbone was to be formed now, we would probably be classified as a jam band because, nice shows.
But it's also, because I mentioned at the very beginning, you mentioned the three bands that I made and Thin Lizzy in Opeth. Now, Opeth, for those of you watching, outside of the death vocal side, that albums like Damnation, it's not so much the twin guitar sound that they, where you notice the Wishbone Ash influence. It's almost like in the ether, this kind of like the acoustic kind of ethereal bits that they put into some of their music. That's the Wishbone Ash bit, which is completely uniquely you. So that when people think of Wishbone Ash, oh, it's the twin guitar sound, there was more to it than that. There was the interplay between the acoustic guitars, the very gentle melody lines. There's a lot more to the Wishbone Ash template than just twin lead.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you can only define something as heavy if there's something juxtaposed against it, like an ethereal light part. And that gets back to the dynamics within the music.
Yeah.
If you've got that, you can't slam an audience's head against the wall for 45 minutes. You've got to give a breather.
Yeah, light and shade, yeah.
And I think that a lot of those early albums, not just our album, but I think the musicians and engineers back in the day with recording LPs, and certainly you hear it in classical music, there are incredibly low points in a recording, and then, you know, the dynamic comes up and the strings fill the...
Yeah. Yeah.
Frequencies. And I think that, you know, that's what we came out of in the early days of making records. And I think that the engineers and the producers, that we were all on the same track. We all realized that the albums had to have that. Well, what's happened now is the bandwidth has gone down and everyone just fills the void with shit ton of notes. It's like, you know, a lot of these guitar players now, they go, oh, he's a fantastic blues guitar player. I mean, he's not a blues guitar player because he's just slamming my head against the wall with a plethora of just, no, he's a rock guitar player. It's just, it's like the blues is all about bringing you into a, you know, a mood and taking you on a journey. And that's the blues element of Wishbone Ash, is always there. It's always taking you on a little musical journey with these guitar solos and the light, the shade, you know, ups and the downs. And I think a lot of that gets lost now. Everyone's just trying to, like, yeah, get in your face.
I think it's like you said earlier, it's the folk aspect and yes. the brass horn arrangement. You said, well, your little guitar motifs. You know, it's the fact that I can walk away and sing a guitar solo in my head or a motif from a song. I'm not even picking on a lyric or a melody. I'm actually thinking, it's your guitars were part of the voices of the band.
I totally agree. I do the same thing myself with other people's music. You know, I may listen to something and see something on YouTube. I'm a whistler. You know, remember when people used to whistle?
Yeah.
Walk down the street, you did some geezer, the postman or the rag and bone man, he'd be whistling. You know, my dad was always whistling out in the garden, and I like to whistle. You know, and I love it. If I hear a girl whistling, I just said to me, that'd be like, I'd be there. But people don't, as a rule, do so much of that anymore.
No, that's very true.
I think that was all of that plays into where the music came from and how it's perceived and what we were thinking about. And I think that's what's interesting about this interview, is that you're getting down into the nitty gritty of what went on in the musicians' minds when we were creating the music. That's what we were thinking about. That we're thinking, how can we make a little tune or a little vignette that somebody's going to, it's going to be an earworm, it's going to stick with them for the day, and then they might whistle it on the way to work.
And I think it's important that, as well, for young bands or young musicians who are, especially if you are playing rock music or heavy metal bands, that you say, well, what were you know, a new band, who were you influenced by? Or were you influenced by Judas Priest and Black Sabbath, whatever? But they're all the same. They're all from the same club. Whereas if you go back to those bands and you talk to Tony Iommi, we're influenced by jazz, we're influenced by... And then you've got a bigger palette, you know, haven't you, to draw?
You're absolutely right. I would not knock a heavy metal band. In fact, you know, I love to go.
Yeah.
I'll go to a heavy metal show. I might leave after half an hour because it's all been said.
Yeah.
But I love the energy of metal. And I love, you know, I mean, I mentioned this a while ago. I went to a Rammstein show with my.
Very theatrical, great band.
We just freaking loved it. We had a great time. But in terms of this band and just what you just said there, I mean, it's a different kettle of fish. You know, it's just a different thing. And you know, we're aiming at a different response. Let's put it that way.
Well, my last two questions are about guitar-based. And this is just observational stuff that I've always wanted to know, because you've always played a Flying V. But your Flying V is different to many because it has a tremolo arm on it. But you're not a guitarist that kind of is always on the wangy bar or even use it that much. But that was obviously a choice to have a Flying V with that on it. Was that?
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, two things. Yeah, a nod towards Hank B. Marvin. I mean,
he was the tremolo.
The greatest user of a... classy use of a tremolo arm.
Using
it to sort of shimmer the notes. And, there were other great aspects about it. Was the fact that if your guitar was slightly out of tune and you were playing chords, you could just create, it was almost like a chorus effect, you know?
Yeah.
So I would use that a lot because you got to remember, back in the days when we first formed the band, there were no digital tuners. We had to do everything by ear.
Yeah.
It's a hell of a thing when you're playing on a big show.
Yeah.
If there were any tuning anomalies, a tremolo arm is a wonderful thing. You know, you can play a chord and, you know.
Yeah. You can just slightly bring it, either make it stop it being sharp or flat. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, that's the Warrior theme.
Yeah. 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 Yes. Now you mention it. Yes, it is. Yeah.
You know, so you've got that thing going on. And those are complicated chords for rock music. Those are chords that they're quite complex, and sometimes they weren't always intonated right. So the tremolo was great for that. And of course, later on, the equipment manufacturers came out with chorus pedals, which also did a similar thing. But pre all of that, you know, that was an amazing invention of Leo Fender, the tremolo arm. Incredible.
And my last question on guitars was actually from, I did find it out yesterday, but I can't find it at the moment. There was this is an interview you did way back in 1974 for a guitar magazine. And it was, they were asking you what your gauge of strings were that you used. And for me and my friends who were like school kids at the time, I think you started off with your top E was like 5. And I always thought it can't be right. And they were all light. They were all light gauge, but like the first one was 5, I think, and then the B was a 10. Was that how can you remember what gauge strings you used to? Have you changed?
It would have been 9. It would have been 9.
Yeah, going to say
nine. 5 is 2. I may have experimented here and there, but not 5. I probably didn't know what a 9 was, but I do know that before they had the lighter gauge strings, you put a banjo string on it.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But I think for the most part, once I got in the recording studio, I actually would go with a light top end, so 9s, 12s, 15s, actually.
Yeah.
But I would go with slightly heavier bottom strings on the guitar because of the rhythm playing.
Of course, yeah.
The rhythm was as much importance to me as the lead playing. And, but, you know, I was a smaller, skinnier kid. Probably that was about as much as I could. I actually can get a lot of sensitivity with a lighter set of strings. You know what I mean?
Yes, of course, yeah.
If you watch, say, Eric Clapton in videos, he's playing very, very gently, very lightly. And I think I was probably the same. It's only in recent years that we've got these more muscular guitar players like Stevie Ray Vaughan and people who, you know, set their guitars up with like 10s, 11s, 12s, and they're slamming into the guitar. And so I go 10s these days, 10s to 48. But I think back in the day, actually just 9s, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you cleared that up because I've always thought a 5, yeah, that's like a human hair.
It really is, yeah, if you have hair, yeah.
Well, you're about to go on tour, aren't you, Andy? Yeah. So you've got some UK dates coming up, and then where are you off to after that?
Well, I'm always about to go on tour, Phil. About half the year on tour, but which I love. But we're doing a few UK dates that we didn't get to on the last tour, which was a long tour. So you know, we're playing places like Colchester and Nottingham and Barnsley, but we're finishing a festival in the north, in Durham area, called the Northern Kin Festival.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then we fly across to France, and we haven't played France since before the COVID pandemic.
Of course, yeah.
So, you know, we really want to get back to some of those French towns and meet some of our old fans, and it's probably been about 4 years, so we're doing about 10 shows over there.
And have you got any recording coming up? Are you working on any new music?
Always got ideas, but nothing's in the can because this is such a banner year, as you mentioned, with the release of this Argus album. You know, the stuff that's coming out. I mean, they're working currently on the BBC recordings, talking about live recordings. There's a plethora of stuff from the BBC, which is some of it's been out, but there's a lot that hasn't, and they're going to try and put it all together in one package. So, you know, I've been spending a lot of my downtime actually working on these box sets and these interviews, you know.
Yeah, that sounds really, because you've just reminded me, because talking to you this morning has brought back lots of things about being a fan of Wishbone Ash, that, yeah, there was a BBC concert from 1974, because I remember taping it on a little Scotch tape on my dad's recorder. So, yeah, that if there are a BBC box set coming out, that will be absolutely fantastic.
A treasure trove.
For
me, it will be, I would just love to have that at home and to sort of, because you only just got to put on those recordings and you're taken. I mean, that's a great thing about music. It just takes you right back to that moment in time and all the things that were going on around the band in my head Yeah. I will listen to that. And that would be just absolutely poetic to get that done. I would just be in heaven to get that. There's something that's really dear to my heart, to get that package together. And I know that Mad Fish are working on it.
Oh, but brilliant. That's so exciting. So
I know the licensing side of it, all that, and grabbing those, getting hold of those recordings, it's a real labor of love. And thank God they do it. So a big kudos to Ian Crockett and the guys at Mad Fish. He's incredible.
No, the attention to detail with the two box sets, the Vintage Years and the new Argus one, is just fantastic. They've obviously thought of it from looking at it through the eyes of a fan.
Yeah.
I thought, if I was a fan of this band,
yeah,
and I take the lid off this box,
yeah,
this is going to make me go, wow.
Yeah,
and the wow factor is there.
They are fans, and I think that's the ethos that compels them forward, But that's taken up a lot of my time when I'm not touring. But yeah, at some point there will be another studio album, and there will be other recordings of live stuff. it goes on. It's a story,
The best place to find out about your tour dates and merch and stuff is wishboneash.com. And you're also on Facebook and everywhere else, I imagine. But yeah, wishboneash.com is where you get all the latest news.
Yeah, I mean, if you really want the day-to-day stuff, there's many Facebook sites for Wishbone Ash, but the one that there's capital W, Wishbone, and then capital A, Ash, Wishbone Ash. That's the one that it's got about 100,000 members, and that's a lot of the day-to-day news goes out. But we're on Instagram, we're on Twitter, and I've got a Patreon site as well. So patreon.com/Andy Powell. There's a lot of behind the scenes videos and things, that a dedicated fan might find interesting. So
I'll put links to all of those in the description of the video and on the website well. And so thank you so much, Andy, for all of your time this morning. It's been absolutely brilliant talking to you. I should probably spend the next few weeks playing nothing other than Wishbone Ash after this chat, but it's been great talking to you. So thanks, everybody. Make sure you check out wishboneash.com and check out nowspinning.co.uk. And I shall see you all soon. Thanks very much, Andy. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Phil. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for tuning in. And a huge thanks to my guest, Andy Powell from Wishbone Ash. And please go to wishboneash.com for all the latest news on their tours and gigs and merch, etc. Also check them out on Facebook and also Andy's Patreon page as well. I'll put the links to those at the end of this video, also in the description tag on YouTube and on the website. And please check out the Now Spinning magazine website at nowspinning.co.uk. Subscribe, become a patron, become a member. And make sure you don't miss out on our future shows, and I shall see you on my next video.